The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So when we talk about underlying health conditions, that includes cardiovascular disease, that includes diabetes, that includes kidney disease, that may include anything that affects your respiratory system, including smoking or vaping. And I'm hearing some reports that obesity itself can be an underlying health condition for this too. So we have to kind of think about what our population risks are looking like. Our healthcare system, I think, is, as we all know, is overall very strong, but also uneven in that not everybody has the same access to care. But even our best prepared hospitals will be unable to deal with a massive surge of patients. There's currently 160,000 respirators in the United States, with another, I believe, close to 9,000 that are available in the Strategic National Stockpile. And if you're running the numbers in your head, in the absence of aggressive social distancing measures, that's just clearly not enough.
I'm Margaret Taylor, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 17th, 2020. Dr. Rebecca Katz is the director of the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. She also teaches global health diplomacy, global health security, and emerging infectious disease in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown. From 2004 to 2019, she was a consultant to the Department of State working on issues related to the Biological Weapons Convention, pandemic influenza, and disease surveillance. On Sunday, we talked about the international legal architecture and institutions for pandemic preparedness and response, how some Asian and European countries have approached the problem, as well as the United States' response. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 523. Rebecca Katz on global health security and the coronavirus response. So, Rebecca, you and I were at a bar mitzvah last month on February 1st, and you leaned over to me and said, I have masks in my purse. And I remember being surprised by that. And it was the first time I really sat up and said to myself, gee, I really have to figure out what is going on with this sort of reporting coming out of China. So why don't you tell the listeners sort of what made you say that way back on February 1st, what your role is and, you know, how you've been tracking and working on this novel coronavirus.
Okay. I think it's probably good to start with what I've been doing for the last 20 years, which is working on the space that we call global health security and pandemic preparedness. And I run a center at Georgetown for global health science and security. And our entire research, teaching, and service portfolio is focused around how do we prevent, detect, and respond to public health emergencies around the world. And so we, and me particularly, carefully track new outbreaks. So we were very carefully watching what was happening with the emergence of the novel coronavirus in China, the dramatic spread that we were seeing in January, particularly in Wuhan and in surrounding areas, and trying to kind of dust off our thinking about what a true pandemic might look like. And so by February 1st, it had already been declared a public health emergency of international concern. So we were already in kind of global governance of disease mode and thinking about what it might look like in the United States.
And who is it that made that declaration that you just referred to?
So the formal declaration, I should also warn you, a lot of my work since 2007 actually has been focused on the international health regulations, which is the treaty, the agreement that we have for global governance of disease. And as part of that agreement, the Director General of the WHO has the power to declare what's called a public health emergency of international concern. And he or she does this with it's very clearly spelled out process within the text of the regulations and done in consultation with what's called an emergency committee, which is experts selected from around the world, but also representing the most affected countries. And the emergency committee then advises the DG, and the DG then makes the declaration. And it's been somewhat controversial because we haven't had too many of these declarations in the past decade. So the first time it was ever used was for H1N1 in 2009. It was also then used for polio in 2014. Even though it's a slightly different situation for polio. Then it was declared for Ebola West Africa, then for Zika, and eventually for Ebola in the DRC. So this is this is the next in the subsequent line of declared public health emergencies of international concern.
And it's my understanding that the World Health Organization did declare this novel coronavirus as a pandemic more recently. And so walk us through your understanding of sort of what that means, why that declaration by the World Health Organization was significant.
So I have to say, I think for governance perspective, the declaration of we call it the FEIC, although there's actually a debate on Twitter about whether you call it a fake or a FEIC or whatever, but the Public Health Emergency of International Concern.
So that's the same thing?
No, they are two different things. So, but I think that the FEIC is actually a more important declaration. So WHO just declared this a pandemic, and they were really quite careful in their language for the past couple of weeks, because clearly this is by every textbook definition that we've ever used in any public health textbook, this is a pandemic. This is widespread. It's now, I think, as of this morning, in over 140 countries around the world, and we are seeing community transmission. So this to anybody in the public health field, this was clearly a pandemic. The challenge with calling it officially a pandemic and calling it officially a public health emergency of international concern is that it is possible, and we don't even know for sure because we've never actually been able to do the full research on this, that those words are triggers, and they're triggers potentially in domestic legislation, potentially with kind of international organizations, potentially with private industry. So sometimes in planning, there'll be language that says, okay, well, you know, if something is declared a pandemic, then we're going to do this. If something's declared a public health emergency, then we're going to do this. But we actually, at this point, this is research that we've proposed, but have never actually been funded to do, because this was, nobody was all that keen on this research space for a long time. So we don't actually have that full database of what those triggers might mean.
So it's very interesting to me, the sort of international response aspect of this. I was noticing in sort of researching all the amazing things that you've done, that way back in June of 2019, The Lancet, which is a weekly peer-reviewed general medical journal, very well respected, was talking about a conference that you put on. Mm-hmm. I think it was something that you put on in mm-hmm. Sydney, Australia, called, well, you can tell us about the Global Health Security 2019 Conference. And in that Lancet piece, you know, it quotes you as saying, the global health security field is actually relatively young. And while a lot of work has been going on in many parts of the world over the past decade or so, the Sydney meeting will be a unique opportunity to bring the key players together to help shape future priorities. I was surprised to read that. Just because, I don't know, I guess maybe I never
specifically thought about global health security as a field, but like, talk to us about that. Why is it, why do you think it's a relatively young field, and what was the sort of importance of the, of that Sydney meeting back in June?
So I was the co-convener of that conference along with my colleague, Adam Kamrat-Scott, the University of Sydney. And the idea behind it was that there have been emergencies, public health emergencies, for a really long time, and we can certainly look at events like 1918 influenza. But as a subdiscipline in global health that was separate from the folks who study things like HIV or workforce issues, there have been a group of academics in pockets around the world who are really starting to focus on the research agenda and how to best provide an evidence base for some of the decision-making that was starting to happen in health security. So I think both Adam and I and some of our colleagues, like we knew the people we knew. We didn't necessarily know the folks we didn't know, right? I mean, that's kind of an obvious statement. But we would get emails from lone researchers at an institution that we weren't familiar with, or from doctoral students who were kind of desperate for advisors. And we realized that it was probably time to form a community of practice and a way to start sharing some of the research that was being done. And most importantly, as a way to bring together decision makers so they could see the evidence base that was being developed. And this was really the first time that we were able to do that. So at this conference, we had approximately 900 people from around the world. We also had a side meeting that was a military health security summit that had another 135 people from 32 different militaries around the world. And it was really exciting, because you would look into a corner and Dr. John Nkegasong, who is the director of the Africa CDC, would be chatting with a doctoral student from the Philippines. So, I mean, it was this way that you actually had decision makers in there, mixing, listening to presentations, and being part of an open dialogue. And the other thing that we were able to do at this conference was we made something we called the Sydney Declaration, which was actually even just trying to define what is health security and what are some of the priorities for action as we move forward. And most of we didn't have a really formal mechanism for this, but almost everybody at the conference signed on to this, whether physically signing a big piece of paper or electronically. And now we're, you know, in a world where every international conference is being canceled, we are planning for the next Global Health Security Conference for June 21. And the other thing that we're doing is we're actually launching a professional society, so the Global Health Security Network, and all that is happening in the next couple of weeks. But as you might imagine, all of us who are involved in this are also a little busy trying to translate our knowledge and our work in the field into supporting the response to COVID.
Okay, so let's go into that a little bit. And let's go back to the international health regulations. You described it as a treaty. I worked up on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for years. I've never heard of this international health regulations treaty. Can you just tell us a little bit about what that is, what it facilitates?
So I use the word treaty. Not everybody does. The international health regulations are an international agreement that were done under the auspices of the World Health Organization, which the United States ratified, right? So we ratified the constitution for the WHO. So it is within that. So it was concluded as an executive agreement, which is great in that it happened, but also challenging because, as you mentioned, the legislative branch wasn't really involved, which means in some ways it becomes a bit of an unfunded mandate. But the IHR, is what we call them, basically descends from the first international sanitary conference. So in 1851, just as the scientific community was starting to better understand the spread of how disease spread, even if they didn't really understand all the science behind it, this was around the same time as John Snow and the pup handle and figuring out, you know, things to do to stop the spread of cholera. So as soon as the scientific community made some inroads in that, the very first thing we do, and we both worked at State Department, was that you bring the diplomats together. And it was all very xenophobic, to be honest. It was 12 nations who came together and said, okay, how do we keep your cholera out of my country? And that was the first International Sanitary Conference in 1851. And then there were a series of meetings going for the next 50-ish years. And they were mostly focused around cholera. And then plague was added, and particularly concerns about plague and the Hajj. And then yellow fever, when we were seeing large outbreaks around the world in yellow fever. And these kind of get grouped together into what became the International Sanitary Regulations. And then when the WHO came into being after World War II, WHO becomes the new owner of this agreement. And then in 1969, they made some slight revisions and renamed them the International Health Regulations, but they were still focused on those three diseases, cholera, plague, and yellow fever. Now, a couple of diseases get added over the years, mostly like deratting diseases, and then smallpox, and then we eradicate smallpox, so smallpox gets taken off. But by the 80s, you still had an agreement. Your international agreement still looked a lot like the one from 100 years ago. And it was still primarily focused on cholera, plague, and yellow fever. And it was still how to keep your disease out of my country. And there was almost no compliance with the agreement, including the United States. So we have naturally occurring plague outbreaks in the Southwest all the time, and we never reported under the IHR. But in the 80s, you also started to have, you started to see a whole bunch of major infectious diseases that had global implications. So you had the spread of HIV/AIDS around the world. You had the emergence of new hemorrhagic diseases. So you were seeing Ebola outbreaks and Marburg and Lhasa. You started to see more and more of these large infectious disease events. And so in the mid-90s, the World Health Assembly, which is the governing body for WHO, comes together and says, you know what? We really need to revise these things. They're not fit for purpose. We have disease, and we need to kind of get with the times because we're now 100 to 150 years behind here. So the World Health Assembly passes a resolution in 95 to say, great, we're going to revise these things, but it wasn't a priority. So nothing really happened until 2002, 2003, when you had the emergence of SARS, also a coronavirus. And SARS really underscored for the global community the critical importance of having global governance. So when SARS emerged, it was really the first time that you could track global. We were now a globalized society, and you could track the flow of this disease as people left one hotel in Hong Kong and traveled all over the world. And the other thing that was there were a couple of main points from the SARS outbreak was that one, the disease had been circulating in China for months before it was reported to the rest of the world. And WHO kind of had its hands tied because it wasn't allowed to use unofficial source of information. The report had to come from the government. So that was the challenge. The second was this globalization, the fact that the disease was going to spread everywhere. And the third was, there were a lot of challenges. The third one was that when WHO finally did learn, I guess more officially, about the disease, it actually came from Dr. Carlo Urbani, who was an Italian physician who was working in Southeast Asia, who actually ends up dying of SARS. And he was part of a network that's called the Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network, GORN. And he was treating a Chinese American businessman who had left Hong Kong and come to Hanoi. And he reported it to WHO. And WHO, it's a Saturday, and the only way they have to communicate with the entire world is through a press release, because we didn't have a communication network set up. So there were all these factors that came in that got highlighted with the challenges of the SARS outbreak. And that really galvanized the global community to kind of get its act together and finally revise the IHR. So everyone came together. Yeah, as you know, how these treaties come. There was the writing groups, but it happened very fast, and they were able to come forward with a revised international health regulations, which were then adopted by the World Health Assembly in May of 2005, and entered into force 2 years later in 2007. And the major changes that were made in this 2005 revised IHR was that. One, no longer are the regulations limited to just these three diseases. Instead, it's now anything that could be a potential public health emergency of international concern. And there's a lovely little annex and algorithm that helps countries determine what could be a potential public health emergency of international concern. So, you know, our diseases are unusual, unexpected, have the potential to cross border, are a major public health concern, might impact international travel and trade. There's a couple of diseases that even if you have one case, they are always going to be, you always have to report them. So that includes like smallpox and SARS, new strains of influenza, wild type polio. And then there's a whole bunch of other diseases that if you have them, you kind of have to work your way through the algorithm. So, and I think that speaks to some of the challenges in global health, where unfortunately a cholera outbreak in Bangladesh is not unusual or unexpected, but a cholera outbreak in New York City would be. So that would be reportable, but not necessarily the one in Bangladesh. So it now applies to any potential public health emergency. It requires every country to be able to communicate 24/7 with the WHO. And with each other. So there's now something called the national focal point. And in many countries, it's actually like a watch center that WHO can now use unofficial sources of information to take action, which is critical because particularly in our world today, when there's so much information flowing, that they have access to all of that. And that you have to be able to control disease at your points of entry, your declared points of entry. And what this treaty does and what is really, I think, very interesting about it is it obligates every country to have basic public health infrastructure to be able to prevent, detect, and respond to any of these potential public health emergencies of international concern. And that's for, you know, the text of the regulation itself is it's not very detailed. It basically says, you know, from the local level to the national level, you need to be able to figure out when something weird is going on. Report it and take at least preliminary response actions. But how that breaks down is to do all of that, it means you need to have functional laboratory, epidemiology, workforce, response. There's a long list of all these what we call core capacities that are now required to actually be able to meet those obligations.
Okay, great. I'm glad you mentioned sort of different countries' capacities and responses to pandemic disease. So I want to kind of bring us into like the current day and ask you about, you know, we've been hearing from around the world how obviously it's the reporting out of China and how China is handling its response to novel coronavirus. Also Italy, some really sort of scary stories coming out of Italy and Iran also. So that's sort of, I think of it as that being in one bucket. On the other hand, you have stories coming out of Singapore, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, where they actually have had, it seems, at least for now, a pretty effective response in being able to get this under control. And so talk to us a little bit about, you know, why is it that Singapore, Taiwan, and Hong Kong are doing quite well? And why is it that countries like Iran and Italy seem to be doing badly? And just comment on, you know, moving to the United States, like where are we falling in that spectrum?
So let me start with talking about Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and South Korea. This is a part of the world that lived through SARS. It's lived through H5N1, the avian influenza. It's lived through all sorts of disease threats that have emerged over the years, which means that not just the governments, but also the population is more prepared for a new public health threat. So that means that, let's take Singapore, for example. So Singapore, I knew there was a threat, rushed to action, immediately started quarantining people coming into the country. They moved towards a very aggressive process to roll out tests and then to then isolate people who tested positive and then to quarantine like the concentric circles around that person to immediately ask the population to restrict their movement, which the population then did and abided by because they're one, their trust in government, but also their experience with disease in past. And those are similar things that we were seeing in Taiwan and Hong Kong and South Korea. So these are all countries that had had experience with outbreaks before, were ready, understood intuitively the danger, took immediate action, and some of very aggressive actions in terms of restricting civil liberties. But the population is more willing and ready to accept that because they also have lived through these outbreaks before in the past.
And just to give our listeners just a little bit of the data, because I was, or statistics I was looking at just in the popular press, you know, as of midday Friday, Singapore had 187 cases confirmed and no deaths. Mm-hmm. And the population there is 5.7 million, which even just looking at, I mean, just seems pretty extraordinary that the case number is so low, no deaths, and, you know, obviously like in close proximity to other countries being affected.
Right. And I think the numbers actually popped up to about 212 today, but there's still zero deaths. But this speaks to the extraordinary measure. So China, as you know, has over 80,000 cases, but they're currently reporting less than a dozen cases in the past 24 hours. And in a country the size of China. And so it really, they have taken extraordinarily aggressive measures to contain the virus. And I think Singapore also took very quick, very aggressive measures. Now, in Italy, for example, so let's remember that Italy, and particularly the Lombardy region, the northern region where this virus has emerged and is spreading most widely, it is a wealthy region. They have more doctors per capita than the United States. They have more hospital beds per capita than the United States, and they have more ICU beds per capita than the United States. So this is a region that is in their health. They have a very strong healthcare system, but they were late to recognize the introduction of infection and the spread of disease, which means that, and you might be hearing a lot of people talking about this idea of flattening the curve. And this is why, because with Italy, what's happening right now is you have a whole bunch of people who are getting sick all at the same time, which means that there's of the percentage of people who require critical care, hospitalization, critical care, and ICU beds, it's a lot of people all at once who are requiring those services. And our healthcare system in the United States, and certainly the healthcare system in Italy, which reminder is better in terms of beds and ventilators and things than we are, just doesn't have this type of capacity. So they are being overwhelmed and having to make horrifically difficult decisions. Because if you only have one ventilator and two or three people need it, these are clinicians who are basically having to say, okay, you get to live and you two people don't. And that is kind of devastating for all parties involved. So that's the situation we're seeing in Italy right now, which is why this whole push for aggressive social distancing measures to slow the spread so that our systems aren't overwhelmed all at once.
And can I just ask you, I did see, I think it was some information out of France about how, you know, I think as I've been looking at this pretty closely, the messaging has been, you know, older people are, in particular, people over the age of, you know, 65 are, they have worse outcomes. This information out of France, though, is that something like half of the ICU patients in France were actually below the age of, I think, of 60. What do you make of, is that right? And what do you make of that?
It might be. I mean, I think a lot of this is, there's demographics involved too, right? So Italy, I think 23% of the population is over 65. I don't know offhand what it is in France, but I do know that we are seeing reports from around the world that in general, I mean, this is important to remember. In general, if 100 people are infected and develop symptoms, approximately 80 will be mild-ish. And that mild is everything from you barely recognize that you have a cold to being quite ill but not quite ready to go to the hospital. And then you have that 20%-ish who may require hospitalization, and about 14 who are going to require more critical, and maybe 6 who require ICUs and ventilators. And then of that, 1 to 2 might die. or depending on the situation, that number might go up to as high as 3 or 4. Or in a really great situation where you have everything under control, less than 1. Like in Singapore, I believe it's like 0.7 as the case fatality rate. So, but that doesn't mean that you don't have individuals who aren't getting ill in different demographics. What we do seem to see is that if you are of a certain age or have some other underlying health conditions, it is more dangerous, that you are more likely to have an adverse experience with the disease. But I think it is demographics and exposure, and there's a lot of things that contribute to who is actually becoming infected and then who's going to have a bad course of the disease. And some of it, honestly, is really random in some cases.
And so translate that into sort of your assessment of how prepared the United States health system is. You know, as you've been looking at and seeing these different countries, where are we here in the US?
Oh, well, and first, a note on the demographics of the US. So when we talk about underlying health conditions, that includes cardiovascular disease, that includes diabetes, that includes kidney disease, that may include anything that affects your respiratory system, including smoking or vaping. And I'm hearing some reports that obesity itself can be an underlying health condition for this too. So we have to kind of think about what our population risks are looking like. Our healthcare system, I think, is, as we all know, is overall very strong, but also uneven in that not everybody has the same access to care. But even our best prepared hospitals will be unable to deal with a massive surge of patients. There's currently 160,000 respirators in the United States, with another, I believe, close to 9,000 that are available in the Strategic National Stockpile. And if you're running the numbers in your head, in the absence of aggressive social distancing measures, that's just clearly not enough.
So that is concerning. Can you also just speak about, obviously, the question of testing is a really important one. It's been in the news. It's, my understanding is that it's like a crucial part of other countries' effective response. What, you know, my father was on the phone with me asking why there wasn't testing here going on in large numbers here in the United States. What's your diagnosis of what happened there, and, you know, what are the prospects for widespread testing in the near future?
So I have to say that I imagine I'll be supervising dissertations on everything that went wrong in the last 2 months for the next 10 years. I think that there's a lot of things that we're going to be dissecting. I think the most important thing at this point is to figure out what do we do now? Our country was a bit delayed, but not a bit, a lot delayed in recognizing the threat, in taking immediate action in terms of getting tests approved and out the door. There were some missteps early on in a test that CDC gave out that was inconclusive, so kind of had to start over. And then there was an issue of getting all the public health labs up to speed. So there have been a lot of challenges over the last 2 months. But at this point, my understanding is that, so you're totally right that testing is critical to the response. It's not the only thing, but it's part of a suite of things that have to be happening in order for us to know what our problem is and to manage it effectively. At this point, many of the major hospital systems are coming online and going to be able to do their own tests. I can tell you that I've heard that MedStar, which is 12 hospitals in the DC area, will be able to do their own tests by, I believe, tomorrow. Quest and LabCorp are able to do their tests now, so the commercial labs, but it's approximately a 36-hour turnaround until you can get a result. And the public health labs across the country have come online too. And now there's a lot of talk of trying to start these drive-through tests as have been done in other countries. And I think that's being rolled out in some places around the country. It's still not what we call point-of-care diagnostics. Like, you can't get your test results in 10 minutes. But at least you can get tested, not expose yourself in the process of getting tested, and then try to get some results so you can take appropriate modifications to your behavior.
Okay, so switching to the sort of response of the federal government, President Trump declared a national emergency on Friday, which my understanding is that that frees up $50 billion in federal funds that would become available for states to combat the virus. What else does that declaration do? And does any of it give you cause for concern, or does it make you, you know, unqualifiedly happy that it has happened? What's your take on that?
Well, the declaration, so there's federal declarations of public health emergency, which we've already have. And then there's federal declarations under the National Emergency Act, so like kind of the non-Stafford Act. And then there's federal declarations of a Stafford Act emergency, which would be the declaration of emergency. So that would allow the federal assistance to supplement any state and local capacity to save lives, protect property, public health, safety. I think I'd like to say it's the right thing, and freeing up the funds, allowing more assistance to go directly to the states, allowing the state's emergency plans to be able to reallocate their resources to provide financial assistance. There's also there's specific language about what this allows under Medicaid and some of the waivers that can be implemented. So all that I think is important and critical at this point. I have to say my own nervousness, I guess, is that I believe, and all you lawyers on here will be able to correct me, but that this also allows for nationalizing the National Guards, which might be critical for providing logistics support and ensuring that, you know, everybody gets the amount of food that they need, things like that. But it's just also a tremendous amount of authority that's now in the executive branch's hands. And one has to believe that those authorities won't be overstepped or be very cautious about them.
Well, that certainly probably will be a subject for a future podcast, I would imagine, on Lawfare. So I know you've done some, speaking about the state response and going forward, I know you've done some work on the sort of variation in state quarantine laws. And actually, I should plug on Lawfare, we actually have been doing summaries of state, you know, rules and regulations regarding quarantine issues. So I'm just plugging that for people who are interested in looking that up.
And it's great. It's very helpful.
Great. Good. I'm so glad. Well, so tell us about your work sort of in that space and what you're thinking about, you know, in the state quarantine laws.
Oh, so, you know, we've actually been looking at issues related to quarantine for quite a long time. And there are some other researchers who've been doing this as well, but we were a really pretty small community because just folks weren't terribly interested. And some of that's a little bit of a failure of imagination. But we've done some work first looking at country comparisons and where examples of quarantine used by political and social environment and some of the methodologies that have been used to enact quarantine, all of this, again, trying to create an effective evidence base for what works and what doesn't.
So you're saying your work is comparing countries rather than states within the United States?
Well, no, both, right? Okay. So we started with some work on comparative work from countries, and then we moved to thinking about the United States. And we did a series of projects. The first was we actually interviewed tuberculosis control officers from around the country because we figured that they were a pretty good proxy for better understanding the resources that local health departments had to isolate patients and what incentives that they might have had available, what worked, and what type of enabling factors actually helped the individuals stay isolated for long periods of time. And from that, we were then able to figure out, okay, what process is necessary? What types of actions will inspire trust? You know, how to only punish noncompliance? How do you promote this culture of social responsibility instead of punishment? And then we did two things. One, we did an accounting and coding of all the state and in some cases local quarantine regulations, because to just get an idea of just how much variation there was in the country. And we found significant variations and also found that a lot of the states had language on the books that just hadn't been updated maybe ever. I mean, things get added on, but not taken off. And so there was still language from some of the older states, like in Rhode Island, they actually still have language about how you fly the yellow flag from your ship, which is very much like love in a time of cholera-ish, right? So you still have language there. You had some really kind of interesting variations around the country. But what we did find was that, you know, we tried to catalog which states included language that was specific to certain civil liberties. So the right to a hearing, right to counsel, language and interpretation services, issues around, you know, whether you on medical treatment, if you have the right to choose your own provider, on compensation around property or how states would deal with people's animals, and then also language around burial and cremation rights or procedures. So we were able to catalog that and then also look at things like what number of states had employment protection. We found 20%, so only 10 states. We looked at minimal payments to individuals not receiving wages, so only 5 had that. Policies in place for, or a budget in place for food and water during a quarantine, and only 12 plans and budget for safe and humane quarantine. That bumped up to 23 different states. There were plans for external lodging, so not at home. Those were 25. And plans for communication devices, only 7. So this is, I should note that this was all work that we did several years ago. And there may have been updates. And I again, point you to the Lawfare work that's being published on what the most up-to-date regulations are. But it was really fascinating for us to take a look at this. And then what we did was we conducted a survey of local health departments. Not all, I think we ended up surveying about 600 of the over 2,000. And what was really interesting from that work was that at the end of the day, we asked, if faced with the decision to use or not use social distancing measures, what would be your biggest concern? And the public health impact and clinical implications together amounted for a little bit more than half of the largest concerns. But then the rest of it, you know, the next 47%-ish was around legal concerns, financial concerns, mm-hmm. political concerns, vulnerable populations, sociocultural issues. And that, I think it's the rest of those that speak to just how complicated quarantine and social distancing measures are and all of the larger context that is involved here.
Yeah. And, you know, as you no doubt know, the House of Representatives passed a bill that is aimed at or seems to be aimed at these sort of more economic impacts or social impacts. You know, there's a paid leave provision, which would, it's a little bit unclear, but would apply to some percentage of workers. That seems to be an attempt at a response to like that side of the House, putting aside, you know, an earlier law that was enacted, which was $8.5 billion for, you know, money for a vaccine, money for a response. Do you have, and I should say this most recent bill that has been passed by the House, because the Senate is out of session this weekend, it has not passed it, but they are expected to pass it, I understand, early this week. So what's your impression of the adequacy of what's in that most recent bill that is expected to become a law this week?
I think it's definitely a positive step. Does it go as far as everybody would like? Probably not. So back to your questions about, you know, looking at parts of Southeast Asia and how effective they've been at controlling the disease. We need to be very thoughtful in how we define what we think works. There are actions that we can take that will work to control the spread of the virus, but at what cost? And you know, these are measures that directly impact civil liberties, human rights, access to food and water, access to communication, the mental anxiety of being isolated. There are implications for other diseases. So we've seen in other outbreaks that actually more people may succumb to like in West Africa, to non-Ebola related issues because all the entire healthcare system is overwhelmed by just Ebola. So I think that is a major consideration. So that we have a lot of factors that are going in here. So I think what is going through Congress right now, and hopefully will be approved by the Senate shortly, is an attempt to try to address some of those challenges. So, you know, to
to, one, ensure that people can get paid sick leave, because right now there is a disincentive from staying home if you don't feel well, for ensuring that people won't lose their jobs if they're, say, under quarantine, for, you know, so try to get at some of these, the economic hardships that will no doubt happen. And there are others way smarter than I who can dissect the details of the bill and figure out where there needs to be more expansive language. But I think the other really important thing to note here is that we are concerned about the most vulnerable people in our society, and vulnerable defined very, very broadly, from the economically vulnerable to the homeless populations, to our undocumented population, and all the trying to address all the different things that might impact their ability to get care, to take the appropriate measures. We also have to think at some point about the private sector at large, and some of the more robust private sector entities are making very aggressive, they're taking aggressive acts, and they're doing it in the name of public health. And I think that, you know, they're not the ones who are going to be struggling with paying their rent tomorrow, but we're also going to have to think long term about ensuring that our economy is back on track, and that some of these organizations are, that they're not penalized for the actions that they've been taking to protect the population.
Right. So creating the right incentives for the right actors seems important. In that vein, I just have to ask, you know, I'm seeing on social media these like huge crowds and lines at major international airports in the United States. I mean, just images of just tons of people like waiting around and standing in lines all together, mm-hmm. you know, for 6 hours trying to get out of the airport. And it just seemed wrong to me. It seemed like that is not something that should be happening at this particular moment. So did you see those images, and what do you make of that?
It makes my head hurt. I think there's a lot of people who are struggling right now to figure out, particularly those who are on travel, who are trying to move, who are trying to figure out what the next travel ban is going to be. But yes, any situation where people are coming together in relatively, you know, tight quarters, and it's dangerous. And that's everything from the folks who were out last night for St. Patrick's Day at bars. It's even, I get nervous seeing the lines at places like Costco, because we are recreating environments where there's opportunity for people to spread disease.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I just have one final question for you. you know, we're all going to be at home. We are with our families, hopefully most of us, or with our housemates, or whatever your situation is. Do you have any recommendations for us about how to sort of get through this time? I know you have kids, I have kids, our kids are friends. What are you sort of thinking about in terms of your own situation, how you're going to get through this sort of period over the next 2 to 4 to 8 weeks?
Who knows? I think we are already relaxing some of our rules about how many hours our kids are allowed to play video games. In part because we both have sons. My son plays a lot of video games, but he plays them with his friends. So in a way, it's like a virtual play date. I think we're all going to be struggling and trying to figure out how best to adapt, and that might change day to day. I've seen people who have come up with kind of structured daily plans for how to work with their kids. I think if you have slightly older kids, it's going to be a bit easier because you don't have to watch them every second of the day. But it's going to be a challenge. This is not easy. None of this is easy. And I think we have to think about this in ways where we are our entire population is going to be making sacrifices, and we're going to be protecting our most vulnerable.
Rebecca Katz, thank you so much for coming on the Lawfare podcast.
Thank you for having me.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. A real and concrete thanks to Jacob Schultz for managing our virtual remote recording. Please share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a review wherever you access this podcast. As always, even in exile, you can purchase merch from thelawfarestore.com. And as always, thanks to Sophia Yan in Beijing
for playing our music, and to Jen Padgett-Howell for her mad editing skills. And thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.